Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Pathfinder 101 podcast. Today's guest is Mr. Kenneth Hirsch. He is the former chairman and CEO of NGP Energy Capital Management and is now the current CEO of the George W. Bush Presidential Center in Dallas.
The first question I have is, could you briefly talk about what you do today and the journey from maybe the start of high school or end of high school to where you are today? Like, what were the different steps involved and how did that all fall into place?
Well, you're going way back in time. High school, I went to Princeton because I got in and it was a top quality school. That's what St. Mark's graduates did back in the day. I went there with the intention of going then to law school. I was on the debate team and I could articulate an argument and people said, you'd be a great trial lawyer. And so I said, you hear that enough? And maybe that's something I'm going to go do. So that's what I set out to do, which is kind of ironic because I didn't do that. Anyway, so I went to Princeton and, you know, probably the biggest thing that happened to me was I was also the editor of The Remarker. And I thought that doing something around journalism would be interesting. And the gentleman, Rick Wechter, who was the editor of The Remarker a year before me, was also at Princeton. And he was on the staff of the Daily Princetonian. And it was one of these things that there were plenty of St. Mark's people, not a lot, but a few that were at Princeton, and they were all involved in the Daily Princetonian. And I didn't want to be part of a daily newspaper. It was a big lift to put out a daily paper. But there was a magazine on campus that was quarterly. And I thought that was a little more interesting. I'd have more of a life filing daily stories. And it happened to be a business magazine called Business Today. So during the freshman week, where all the signups were, there was another Dallasite who didn't go to St. Mark's, but he worked on the Business Today magazine. He said, Ken, you ought to come do this. It's a little bit easier than the Daily Princetonian. And I didn't know anything about business, but I signed up because of that. And that was probably one of the more interesting right turns in my path, because I then went to some meetings and started listening to people talk about how we're going to write articles for Business Today magazine. And so I wrote a couple and I went to the planning sessions and the editorial meetings and the circulation meetings. And next thing you know, they asked if anybody wanted to sell ads. And I said, I can try that. And so I started writing and selling ads and helping produce Business Today magazine. And ultimately, I ended up moving up the ladder at that organization where I became managing editor of the magazine. And then that magazine also put on a national conference. And I spent my summer jobs after my freshman year, sophomore and junior year, I did my summer jobs planning for and raising money for both the magazine and the conference program, ended up becoming president of the organization. And so then all of a sudden I became more interested in business along the way. And so I thought I would apply to both business school and law schools and get a JD MBA. So I was doing that while I started interviewing. And I went to an information session for an organization called Morgan Stanley, which I thought was a law firm. They advertised shrimp dinner in the Daily Princetonian information session for Morgan Stanley. And I thought it was a law firm. And because I didn't have a meal contract my senior year and it said shrimp dinner, I said, oh, I'll actually go for a information session and I'll get a free meal out of the deal. And I got there and they said, we're an investment bank. And I thought, investment bank, like a checking account? What does that mean? And they said, no, we don't have checking accounts, although I'm sure our clients do. We have a brokerage account where we buy and sell stocks for our clients, but we also have investment banking, M&A advisory. I'm like, what the hell is that? But I listened and learned. That kind of opened my eyes to these analyst programs that they had on Wall Street. Morgan Stanley had started the analyst program. This would have been in 1984. About 5 years earlier, they had started the analyst programs on Wall Street. It was only a few years old that the investment banks had these things called two-year analyst program. So I was busily applying to law schools and business schools while I was then interviewing for investment banks. And long story short, I got into the business schools. I didn't really have great success at the law schools. And so I said, the market must be telling me something. I'm really good at this business stuff, but maybe the law stuff can wait. And then I was fortunate enough to land a job at Morgan Stanley and get into Stanford Business School. And I said, this is my first lesson in do what the market is telling you you're good at. That was the big shift in my path. The second thing was when I showed up at Morgan Stanley as an analyst, they put me in the energy group because I was from Texas and I didn't know anything about energy. I didn't know the difference between natural gas and gasoline, but my parents were economics professors and a podiatrist. And they said, you should go there anyway. And so that's where I ended up. And it happened to be where lots of action was happening on Wall Street at the time. And the deal business was in the energy groups. And so I learned the energy business by cranking numbers as a young analyst.
Could you talk a little bit more about from that point until how you ended up like where you are today?
Well, from that point, I did 2 years at Morgan Stanley, 18 months in the energy group, my last 6 months in their Chicago office. I decided to volunteer to be an analyst in another office, which was very exciting because I got a lot more independence. I went to Stanford Business School. And then what's been well reported about my background is that I wrote for a summer job. I didn't want to go back to Morgan Stanley or back to Wall Street because it was very transactional. And I wasn't quite as proud of the transaction environment as I was about the investing environment. And there was a thing emerging at the time called principal investing, which we would now call family offices, but it was people investing their own money. And so a buddy at Morgan Stanley said, you know, there's this guy in Fort Worth named Richard Rainwater, and he used to work for the Bass Brothers, and now he's gone off on his own. Maybe he needs a summer employee. And I said, oh, that sounds great. You mean he's only been away from the Basses for a couple of years? I had heard of the Bass Brothers, but didn't know much about him. And maybe he's just sitting around waiting for somebody like me to write him a letter and show up and help him out. So I wrote him a letter, a cold call letter that said, I'm looking for a summer job. And I attached my resume and I sent it. And out of the blue, he called me and he said, I called so-and-so back at Morgan Stanley. And they said, you were really great and I should be talking to you. So let's talk. And I thought it was one of my friends who was messing with me because I would never think that he would call me out of the blue. I was waiting a couple of days to be respectful and before I followed up with him, but he did. And so he said, when can you get here? I said, well, let me work on that. So I quickly was interviewing with McKinsey at the time for my summer jobs. I was interviewing with a whole bunch of people and McKinsey had an office in Dallas. And I said, well, I could work in your Dallas office. And they said, really? And I said, yes, but I'd like to see it if you don't mind. Now they didn't necessarily say, well, but you're already from Dallas. Why do you need to see Dallas? But they said they were so excited that a Stanford student didn't pigeonhole themselves and say, I only want to work in your San Francisco office. And so they flew me down to Dallas. And then I called Rainwater's office. I said, well, I have a time that I'm coming to Dallas. Can I come over to Fort Worth and see you? So I had a free plane ticket to Dallas. And then I was able to parlay that to a meeting. And when I was in Richard Rainwater's office, he said to me, you know, I really wanted to meet you, but I really don't have any summer jobs, but I just wanted to meet you. And so under my breath, I was like really disappointed. Like I came all this way and now I got nothing. That morning, Richard had a meeting with the folks at McKinsey who had presented to him their view about the natural gas market, that supply was dropping and demand was rising and prices were going to go up, just like a supply and demand chart will tell you they would. And he had that on his desk. And so he turned it around and sent it to me. And he said, well, what do you think of this? You're in the energy group. And so I took this little blue book and started flipping through it. And I said, tell you what, Richard, how about for my summer job, I take the McKinsey view of the world and put together a investment strategy on who would win and who would lose based upon this view of the world. And he said, write me a proposal. So I did. And he said, okay. And I ended up working at McKinsey for my days. And at night I moonlit putting together this study. And at the end of the summer, presented it to him in his office and was available to present it to a group who came in the office, who ended up putting up some money, putting up all the money. And Natural Gas Partners was born in part out of that piece of work.
Could you talk about how your day-to-day job looked at Natural Gas Partners and then what made you transition from there to where you are like right now today?
Well, you know, you're compressing about almost 30 years in that sentence. That partnership became Natural Gas Partners, which we were born with some money and a silly name, and we built it into a firm. What started as a partnership to take advantage of rising prices turned out to be dead wrong. The McKinsey thesis was dead wrong. But we said, you know what? Let's not build a business based on prices. Let's build a business based upon maybe declining prices. That if commodity prices are going to go down all the time, maybe we ought to find ways to make money in that environment. So let's find people who can increase volumes or decrease costs in a way to find oil and gas properties that will do well if prices go down. And so that's what we did. We morphed our business model after about year three. And at that moment, everything took off and we grew the firm over years. The other thing that was important wasn't just pivoting after the McKinsey. It was apparent that the McKinsey model was wrong, but our biggest investor, which was the Equitable Insurance Company, in the early 90s, they went bankrupt. And so we had to go find other partners. And that forced us to get out on the road and defend our thesis and defend our track record. And in hindsight, that was very fortuitous because we were able to cultivate relationships with other investment partners and develop our firm into what is now widely viewed as a private equity fund, where you have a general partner and you have many limited partners. But that started because we had to, by necessity. But then we were able to build and grow the firm to one of the most successful private equity businesses in North America, not just focused on energy, but focused on any industry. But we were able to do it focused on energy. And we built that over the years. We added investment products along the way. We had a debt fund. We had a midstream fund. We had an energy technology fund. And we had an agriculture fund. And so we were really becoming more than just an energy private equity firm. We were becoming an asset management business. And we did that very successfully, although not without cycles, because these businesses all have cycles. But I was very proud to have assembled an incredible team that was able to really create staying power and build a durable brand, an investment brand in the natural resources sector. And so NGP, we morphed our name from Natural Gas Partners to NGP Energy Capital Management along the way, and really created systems and partners that had developed the brand across a host of product lines, investing in an industry sector. And that went really, really well and still does to this day. So, you know, building a team, creating systems, creating a brand, were all, you know, objectives of mine as we matured over the years. Along the way, you know, it was interesting for me to personally turn the business over to the next generation of executive. And that one of the issues in the private investment business that's quite difficult is to depersonalize your firm from your people, especially if you have founders. And myself and David Alvin and a couple other people had been there since day one, which included John Foster. And, you know, we were all getting older. There was a great crop of young partners that were doing phenomenally well. And it was our opportunity to set the place up for a generational change so that this place would live on. We were very lucky that we didn't put our names on the door day one. You know, that's one of these things that, you know, a lot of firms will put the names of their founders on, which is very nice when you're growing. But later on, people are going to think if they're not talking to the founders, they're talking to the B team, and because the founders' names are on the door. And we were lucky that, again, by an accident, our firm was named and we didn't put our names on the door. That was dumb luck. But that turned out to be a really great asset because we were able to grow without, and then we were able to set up the organization with a very, very flat organization with lots of great young partners who were representing our firm everywhere. And so when that happened, it enabled us to turn over the reins more smoothly. And so from a professional standpoint, it just became time to turn over the reins. And, you know, I found it a great opportunity to give back and to do something in the nonprofit world where I was able to take these skills of building a franchise, of building a system, of creating something that has permanence, and doing it with a great team here at the Bush Center. And it hit at the exact right time in my life where there was a transition happening at the Bush Center. President Bush and the board said, Ken, would you do this? I was happy to do it.
It seems that you've experienced sort of the starting a business or entrepreneurial cycle from the start. Could you talk about some lessons that you've learned? Like you mentioned the not putting your name on the door and how that influenced. Could you talk about some more anecdotes or lessons that were really important to you?
Yeah, I mean, the most important thing, as it sounds trite, is you're only as good as your team. And as a leader, your job is to get in there and be all in with your team. And I wanted to establish a strong culture. I did it at NGP with great, great partners and great team members. And we were able to operate like a family. And families have each other's back. And building that camaraderie and that sense of trust and communication means you can weather really violent cycles. And in the oil and gas industry, there's wild commodity cycles and of ups and downs. And so you have to be able to have a team that doesn't jump ship when things, you know, go down, because things are going to go down. And so that taught me a lot about how to build a culture that's resilient and that has high levels of communication and high levels of trust and high levels of respect for the people in your offices. And that's really important. So when I took the job at the Bush Center, it was no different, about building and continuing to build on the team that they had here, continuing to enhance the culture so that the culture is one of trust and communication and excellence, that compensation, you can measure outcomes, and that you can build incentive and compensation systems accordingly. Just because you're not in the private sector doesn't mean that people can't be well compensated or can't have a good work-life balance or can't find good ways to reward people. And so we built reward systems in. So, I mean, that was all very, very consistent, both in the for-profit and the not-for-profit sector. I get asked the question a lot, you know, how hard is it to transfer the managerial skills? I say it wasn't hard at all because it's the same. It's about building a vision, about building, having a value statement, about creating a corporate culture. And that culture relies upon being able to assemble great people who are motivated, who want to do a great job, who feel well-respected. And as a leader, you know, my job is to go all in and go all in with them. I have a messy desk just like they do. And my job is to be a resource to help them do their job well. I learned that along the way, that's really important. Didn't always do that at NGP and learned just like everyone else learns as they've gotten older. I found it to be so important. Build a great team and build a great culture and have a great unifying vision. And it's amazing what people can do together.
You've mentioned some of the overarching goals as your role as CEO at the Bush Presidential Center. Could you talk about some of the daily aspects of your job, like what a typical day looks like?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there are no typical days, but I would say that my job here is pretty simple, and that is to help the Bush Center become sustainable for the long term. The challenge of the Bush Center is there's a guy's name on the door, and that guy has a heartbeat. And President Bush has an incredible sense of public service, incredible sense of personal values around the concepts of freedom, opportunity, accountability, and compassion. And he wants this place to live beyond him. And so by doing that, we have to make sure that we're set up so it's not all about him, because he's not always going to be here. Now, we're blessed that he has such an active presence here, but it's important that we build the Bush Institute to have thought leadership and spokespeople that aren't just about setting up the next Bush event. And we need our thought leadership to be in the areas that we cover to be top flight. We need to have events that are intellectually interesting and that are well attended and are well regarded and are well quoted. And to start those processes now, we need to have leadership programs that build alumni networks that are powerful and wonderful ambassadors, which will grow over time. We need to have events that are repeatable and strategic. We need to have engagement around the country and around the world that people want to engage in the work that we're putting out, not just waiting for President Bush to say something. And then we need to be sustainable financially, which we've done through building an endowment. And so if I'm able to do all those things, then while President Bush is here and very active and very engaged, then, you know, at some point, you know, far in the future, when he may not be active or be present, this place will still live beyond. And that's really been what I've been just proud to be a part of, building this place out for the future so that it has permanence as an institution and not just as a family office. So my day is, some days it's heavy in the policy side, some days it's heavy in the personal engagement side, sometimes it's heavy in the management side, but I consider myself first and foremost the head cheerleader of an incredible team here.
I think the way you phrased that whole answer was really like revealing about what you do. So thank you for that. In terms of skills required for a job, they can range anywhere from like technical skills to the soft skills and networking. And often those two, like the soft skills, networking, interpersonal skills, those can be more important than the actual technical skills themselves. And I'm sure like you recognize the importance of that as you've been CEO of multiple companies and played many leadership roles. So can you talk about not necessarily like what exactly networking is, but how to, or interpersonal skills are, but how to become better at these skills, develop them over time, some habits that might help in that?
Well, I think the most important thing is to be a lifelong learner. A good idea does not know seniority, and a bad idea doesn't know seniority. I haven't cornered the market on good ideas or bad ideas. And so to me, it's all about really assembling people who are smart, who are motivated, who understand the vision, and then to create an environment where people can talk and communicate, and create safe environments where people can talk and communicate, create diverse environment where people can talk and communicate, because that's where good ideas happen. When somebody blurts out an idea and says, oh, that's kind of cool. What if we added that? And all of a sudden you have lots of people building on one thing. But if people are quiet and say, oh, I don't want to say anything because they might think I'm dumb, or they might be crazy or whatever, you know, you want to make sure you've created a safe environment where people can interact with each other. And that to me is my number one job, because I am myself curious and I love those brainstorming moments and I really learn from them and I feel like I can add to them. Or hey guys, let me throw something out here, maybe really crazy. And you know, people say, Ken, that was crazy. I said, okay, well, all right, what do you got? You know, I mean, to me, that's what makes it fun to go to work. And being surrounded by really smart people who care about the mission and the vision, then to me, I just have to be an equal participant. I think it's important to remain intellectually curious, to remain interested in learning. I mean, that to me is, if I do that right, it can become infectious. Then things just amazingly take care of themselves.
I know we're reaching the end of our time, but just one last question. So yeah. You mentioned a lot of great advice for anyone in general. If there's another specific advice that you could add on to that, specifically for people at the end of their high school careers, junior, senior year, ready to go to college and beyond, what would that piece of advice be?
Don't overthink it. People who, if you spend a lot of time talking about your 20-year plan, you know, the world's going to change 10 different times over the next 20 years. It may change more than that. It may change 20 times. And so remaining intellectually curious, remaining flexible. If opportunity presents itself, don't be afraid to say, maybe. You don't have to say yes, say maybe, and raise your hand and say, let me take a cut at this. And things happen if you put yourself in front of an opportunity and don't be afraid to say, I'll try, why not me? You know, I think that's the most important thing. People who feel so scripted on a life plan may not be intellectually available when something like that opens up. And I think that's really important, is that when a door opens that might have an opportunity in it, don't be afraid to look in that door and take that first step. Failure is very seldom fatal, and it's okay. And that's what the great thing about this country is, that you can try things. If they don't work, you can pivot. Stay true to a set of values and a true north direction, but don't be afraid to pivot if the opportunity arises. And I think that's the most important thing. I see young people sometimes overthink it, because they, you know, one time I was going to go to law school, and I did get into some law schools, but I got into some business schools also, but I wasn't afraid. Once upon a time, I went to a shrimp dinner for an information session of what I thought was a law firm, and I learned something, and it changed the course of my career and life. I wrote some guy a cold call letter. You know, how did I do that? Well, I asked around. And so anyway, those are things that if you just leave yourself a little bit of wiggle room, it's amazing what can happen.
Thank you for all those answers, all the advice, and again, for your time. Really appreciate it, and had a great time talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyone who's listening for choosing to spend your valuable time with this podcast. I really appreciate it. Please be sure to check out pathfinder101.com for more information like this. Thank you, and have a great rest of your day.